saying. P&I.
Yes, Gascoigne said, shaking his head. Well, there's a good chance that Mr. Lauderback, if he owned several ships, belonged to some sort of a shipowners' association. There's a good chance that he paid a yearly fee into a mutual fund called P&I as an additional insurance that was of a slightly different nature than what you and I might think of as conventional cover.
To protect the cargo?
No, said Gascoigne. P&I works more like a mutual pool, into which all the shipowners pay a yearly fee, and out of which they can then draw down funds if they find themselves liable for any damages that regular insurers refuse to touch. Liabilities of the kind that you're facing now. Wreck removal, for instance. It's possible that Godspeed could remain protected, even though the ownership of the ship has changed.
How? He spoke the word without curiosity.
Well, if P&I was taken out some years ago, and this is the first significant accident that this particular ship has sustained, then Mr. Lauderback might be in credit against Godspeed. You see, P&I doesn't work like regular insurance. There aren't any shareholders, and no company, really. Nobody's looking to make a profit off anyone else. Instead, it's a cooperative body of men, all of them shipowners themselves. Every man pays his dues every year until there's enough in the pool to cover them all. After that, the ships stay covered, at least until something goes wrong, and then somebody has to dip into the pool for some reason. The notion of being in credit applies very nearly.
Like a private account, Carver said. For Godspeed.
Exactly.
Carver thought about this.
How would I know about it?
Gascoigne shrugged.
You could ask around. The association would have to be registered, and the shipowners would have to be listed by name. This is assuming that Lauderback indeed belongs to such a group, of course. But I would venture to say that it's very likely that he does.
In fact, this was more than likely. It was certain. Alistair Lauderback did have protection and indemnity against all his crafts, and each ship was in credit to the tune of nearly £1,000, and Carver was legally entitled to draw down these funds to help pay for the removal of the wreck from the Hokitika Spit, so long as he filed his appeal before the middle of May, whereupon a year would have passed since the sale of the craft, and Lauderback's legal obligation to Godspeed would cease. Gascoigne knew all this for certain because he had made the inquiries himself, first in the offices of Balfour Shipping, and then in the news archives of the Times, and then at the Harbour Master's office, and then at the Reserve Bank. He knew that Lauderback belonged to a small cooperative of shipowners called the Garrity Group, so named for its most prominent member, John Hincher Garrity, who was, as Gascoigne had discovered, an enthusiastic champion of the Age of Sail, the imminent twilight of that era notwithstanding, and who was also, it transpired, the incumbent Member of Parliament for the electorate of Heathcote in the East, and Lauderback's very good friend. We ought to clarify that Gascoigne had made these inquiries in the service of a separate investigation, one that was not concerned with maritime insurance or with John Hincher Garrity in the slightest. Since the night of the 27th of January, he had spent long hours in the harbour master's office, poring over old logs and old pages of the shipping news. He had worked with Löwenthal to examine all the old political bulletins in the Leader, the Otago Witness, the Daily Southern Cross, and the Littleton Times, and he had skimmed through all the archives at the courthouse that pertained to George Shepherd's appointment, the temporary police camp, and the future jail. He had been looking for something very particular. One thread of evidence to connect Shepherd to Lauderback, or Lauderback to Crosby Wells, or Crosby Wells to Shepherd, or perhaps to connect all three. Gascoigne felt very sure that at least one of these possible connections was significant to the mystery at hand. So far, however, his research had turned up nothing useful at all. The discovery that Godspeed was insured against extraordinary damages was no exception to this nothing useful, for Lauderback's insurance history had no bearing upon the case of Crosby Wells, and nor was it connected in any way to George Shepherd, or to the jailhouse currently under construction. But Gascoigne did have some experience in the field of maritime insurance, as he had admitted to Francis Carver, and he had not lied in saying that the subject was of some curiosity to him, being the profession of his former father-in-law, and therefore the subject of much drawing-room conversation over years past. He had made a note of Lord Abak's affiliation to the Garrity Group with interest, filing it away in his mind as something to be examined in better detail at a later time. Abel Gascoigne knew that Francis Carver was a brute, and he did not care to court his friendship. He felt, however, that to get Carver on his side would be somehow valuable, and he had solicited the other man's attention on the spit that afternoon with that purpose in mind. Carver was still thinking about protection and indemnity.
"I suppose I'd need Lauderback's consent," he said, "to lay claim to that cover. I suppose I'd need him to sign something."
"Perhaps you would," Gascoigne replied, "but the fact that only 10 months have passed since Godspeed changed hands might be worth something. That might be a loophole."
Indeed it was.
"And the fact that you inherited a standard policy from Lord Abak might be worth something, too. Why, if you inherit the whole, you inherit its parts, do you not?"
"Indeed you do." With a flourish, Gascoigne